It's Tuesday, July 13th. They say they want to make it easier to vote, just not for themselves. We start here.
Bye, Texas.
In an act of coordinated defiance, Democratic lawmakers flee Texas.
They're really kind of delaying the inevitable.
They say they're not returning home until a Republican voting bill is dead. We'll explain. Is there a new revolution brewing in Cuba?
People are really angry and very frustrated.
How the outrage boiled over. We'll take you to Havana. And your boss wants you back at the office, but is it all about productivity? Really?
What you have right now are huge amounts of commercial real estate that is going unused.
The factors CEOs aren't saying out loud and what you can do to keep a more flexible schedule. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
One of the less sexy words in the world is quorum. Like, no one gets psyched when the Latin starts getting busted out. But a quorum is basically the minimum number of people you can have at a meeting to make it official, to get it on the record. So if two people on your condo board get together and quietly decide to make a new rule, nuh-uh, you need a quorum. Well, this is also the rule that allowed Texas Democrats to completely halt a bill earlier this summer that was about to become a law.
There are 86 A's, 0 nays. The motion to excuse fails for lack of quorum.
The Democratic Caucus Chair Chris Turner sent a text message to spread the plan. Members, take your key and leave the chamber discreetly. Do not go to the gallery. Leave the building.
On the last day of the legislative calendar, Democrats literally sneaked away from the Texas State House in Austin to keep this voting security bill in limbo, to which Republican Governor Greg Abbott said, "This is ludicrous. We're just going to schedule a new session solely to pass this bill."
Governor Abbott tweeted late last night, quote, "Election integrity and bail reform were emergency items for this legislative session. They still must pass."
The thinking here was, yeah, you can hide for a day, but you can't deny us a quorum for a full month. To which Democrats are saying, want to bet?
And that breaking news on this Monday happening in Austin, where Texas Democrats are now walking out of the special session, even leaving the state.
And so now, with one of the nation's most restrictive voting laws up for debate, some of these Texas lawmakers have fled, not just the building, but the state they represent. Let's go straight to ABC's deputy political director, Avery Harper. Avery, this is like escape from Alcatraz, but escape from Austin, right? Like, what is going on here?
Right. Well, in Texas, there is a rule that state troopers can sort of round up lawmakers who have escaped or left the Capitol and bring them back to the Capitol. And so what we have seen now to prevent the passage of this elections bill.
Hey, everybody, this is Texas State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher. Just arrived here in Austin at the airport, about to leave to go to Washington to fight for voting rights.
We've seen more than 50 legislators not only just leave Austin, but leave the state entirely.
This is a now or never moment for our country. We're all in this together.
Many have traveled to D.C. where they plan to speak with the press today about their game plan.
Bye, Texas.
But right now that game plan is pretty unclear because they're really kind of delaying the inevitable, which is that this bill is going to pass because they just do not have the votes to stop it.
Well, and just so I get the mechanics of it, like, these people work for the state of Texas. Like, they get a taxpayer written check, right? Do they keep getting that when they leave the state? And is there a method by which the state government, I guess the state troopers can't go outside of Texas to get them back?
Right. And that's exactly why they've left the state, because if they were anywhere in the state of Texas, they would have been able to be rounded up by state troopers.
Anybody that's done a walkout, you go back and look at Texas history, from the killer bees to what happened in Ardmore and Albuquerque in 2003, they've always lost.
And we've seen it in the past. They've had lots of fights within the state house previously, where we've seen state reps, you know, go right over the border to, say, in Arkansas or in Oklahoma, to avoid having to face the music down in Austin.
Any member of the legislature will be walking out on property tax relief, foster kids, the security of our farmers and ranchers on the South.
We've
Texas
seen
border.
Governor Abbott threaten funding for the legislature. And while in Texas, the legislators themselves are part-time, so it might not be a big deal, it would also have prevented their staffs from getting paid, and those folks are full-time.
And so what is the status then of this bill? You said this is kind of like delaying the inevitable. This bill, one of the most hardcore in the country, if it ever passes.
Right. It is pretty restrictive. We're talking about taking away and limiting hours and making it harder to vote via mail, and also harder to vote early.
Representative Clardy, these new bills, they're missing some of the provisions that were in the previous legislation. For example, there's no longer a provision restricting voting on Sundays or a measure to allow election officials to overturn results if there are voter fraud allegations. Why make these changes?
Well, I'll tell you, we would have made those changes had everybody stayed home second before last day of session, and we voted the bill out and it had passed.
This is eventually going to pass, but they're not going to be able to pass it tomorrow because there's not enough folks who are going to be in the state house in order to debate it.
We all believe firmly that there is no voter fraud in this state. So this is a solution in search of a problem.
And the Texas Democrats who are in D.C. say the reason for them being in the nation's capital is to lobby for support of federal election reform.
It takes two parties to work in a bipartisan way. Ultimately, what we will need is federal legislation passage.
Things like the For the People Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. But the fact is that it's Republicans in D.C. who are holding it up.
Ultimately, the Republican majority will probably get what they want, and we need federal help.
And so it's really just delaying the inevitable. This is not going to keep voting legislation from passing in Texas.
Well, right. And so if the concern here, I'm just trying to think about this from sort of a political optics thing. If the concern here is about Democrats are saying we want to avoid a broken democracy, does that get remedied by a bunch of people literally packing up and leaving, going to another region where they have no jurisdiction, by the way, taking campaign contributions throughout this, saying, you know, help support me here. Does that improve where we are as a democracy, Avery?
No. The lieutenant governor of Texas called it anarchy.
Some of us are willing to sit down and negotiate, but we're not going to negotiate our the right to vote away either.
The Democrats that I've spoken with from Texas vehemently disagree.
They say they're in it for the long haul.
As long as it takes to kill this legislation, whether that is a few days or whether that's for the remainder of the special session, that's up to the Republicans.
They believe that this is the only tool they have to make their last stand, and so they're going to use it.
All right, wild scene there in Texas, now D.C. In fact, later today in Philadelphia, President Biden will be giving a speech on voting rights. Avery Harper, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, we don't see protests in Cuba. So what launched not one, not two, but dozens of flare-ups across the island? We go to Havana after the break. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there should be no compromise. Don't go back to that one doctor. You know the type, like I've had this person before, that doesn't actually listen to you or who seems just in a rush to end your appointment that you spent months making. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. You can search by location, availability, and insurance. So no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you got more options than you know. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. Go to ZocDoc.com/start here and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/start here. ZocDoc.com/start here. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. We've been covering how suddenly everything can change in a country like Haiti, how politics and poverty can create a powder keg just waiting for a spark. Well, right near Haiti, on the island of Cuba, sparks are flying.
The word you will hear is unprecedented.
The largest demonstrations in nearly three decades in a country notorious for cracking down on dissent.
You might have seen the images of protests underway in the Western Hemisphere's most restrictive country. This is just not something you see there. Not under Fidel Castro, not under Raul Castro, and not under their successor, Miguel Diaz-Canel. Which is making people ask, are we witnessing something more significant than just anger in the streets? Let's take you to those streets right now. Reed Lindsay is an independent documentary filmmaker. He's covered conflict zones around the world. He was working on a project covering Cuban-American relations. As this all popped off, Reed Lindsay, where are you right now, by the way?
Thanks, Brad. I'm in our office. I work with a media organization called Belly of the Beast. We cover Cuba and U.S.-Cuba relations right in the middle of Havana.
And so, you know the country well. Can you just put into context what the heck happened primarily on Sunday?
Well, protest erupted in different parts of the country and different parts of Havana. Definitely a surprise. There has not been anything like it for decades. It happened in the midst of a social media campaign called SOS Cuba, which it's not clear how it began or where it began. I was actually in a part of Havana called Regla, and started hearing about protests in other parts of the country. I found out there was a protest in Regla, so I ran out and found it. There were a couple hundred people in the street, which was sort of an astounding thing, because it just doesn't happen. There are sometimes very small protests of hardcore dissidents, but more generalized protests where a larger number of people join are sort of unheard of.
Demands for freedom echoing across Cuba, from one end of the island nation to the other.
They were shouting freedom and down with the dictatorship, and really the chants were about the political system and about civil liberties, but it was pretty clear the people who were marching were really out there because of the economic situation, and it didn't really grow. That protest didn't grow that much larger, and it was peaceful. The police were there. They didn't do anything. They were very passive. And then I later went to Havana, to the downtown, where there were clashes with police. Although very different from other places I've covered, no tear gas, no rubber bullets. So in some ways, there was violence. In other ways, it was much less violent than other places I've covered.
And so, was this then about, like you mentioned sort of the chance that people were saying, was this about personal freedoms and civil liberties and the regime per se, or was this strictly about personal economics? Like what is the root of this anger, I guess?
Yeah, it is anger. People are really angry and very frustrated. And I would say that's generalized across the population, because Cuba is undergoing a tremendous economic crisis. Even before COVID, things were really bad here. Primarily due to U.S. sanctions.
As President of the United States, I've called on our Congress to lift the embargo.
Now, you know, Obama started to open things up.
It is an outdated burden on the Cuban people.
Things really were improving in Cuba. The economy was starting to improve. There was way better relations with the United States, unprecedented relations, at least since the Cuban Revolution occurred.
I am canceling
the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba.
Trump rolled all that back and then some.
The Trump administration has announced new restrictions for Americans traveling to Cuba, including a ban on cruise ships.
And under Trump, he intensified sanctions. Since Biden was elected, he has not changed any of that. Trump's policies have essentially remained, and it's taken a toll. Now, when COVID came, it just exacerbated things.
This woman voicing her concerns directly to President Miguel Diaz-Canel, asking for COVID-19 vaccines with a rise in new cases and a shortage of food and medicine.
You know, you could go and buy chicken, you wait an hour in line, it's a bit of an inconvenience, you could still get chicken, for example. But once COVID hit, shortages really became much worse. So people waiting in line for 6, 7, 8 hours to buy chicken, for example, or to buy detergent or to buy soap. And recently, much worse. So even products that normally you just take for granted you'd find in Cuba, like sugar, coffee, and worst of all, medicine. So when you combine the people having to wait in line for hours, the scarcities of food, of basic products like soap and detergent, and then now medicine, and then for the first time, COVID cases really surging in a part of the country, combine all that, and a tipping point seemed to have been reached, and people took to the streets.
Well, and so then I feel like you could interpret this in one of two ways, right? One, you could say our policy under that we've had for decades, but specifically the heightened embargo under President Trump and now under President Biden, could result in a humanitarian crisis, right? People are starving. Or two, if your goal is to watch the Cuban regime crumble, couldn't you say President Trump might have brought us closer to that than any president in half a century?
Well, there's a famous memo written April 1960 by Lester Mallory. He was Assistant Deputy Secretary of State before the embargo went into place. And he wrote basically an argument for the embargo and why it was needed. And he said the embargo was needed in order to cause economic desperation, hunger, to cut off money and supplies from Cuba. And as a result, people would rise up.
The Biden-Harris administration stands by the Cuban people.
For 60 years, the embargo certainly has caused all of these economic problems. They have not been able to overthrow the government.
At the heart of the review and at the heart of the policy that will result are democracy and human rights.
But the U.S. government has said that they are punishing the state, and it's not. But really, the ones who pay the price are the Cuban people.
Right, right. Although we've heard many Cuban Americans saying, no, this is clearly an issue with the regime, that they created this problem. The State Department yesterday effectively said, listen, the Cuban regime could change their policies whenever they want, that this is on them. But in the meantime, like you said, there are people saying, you know, it's fine to think about the regime coming down. That's all well and good. In the meantime, even if that happens, don't forget people are literally starving. The U.S. will have to consider what it should do if there's an even more dire humanitarian crisis unfolding just off the Florida coastline. Reed Lindsay there in Havana. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Brad.
The coronavirus pandemic is still a pandemic, still sending about 17,000 Americans to the hospital every day. Of those, little more than 200 are dying every day. Virtually every single one of those people is unvaccinated. That means doctors, nurses, and government officials still have their work cut out for them. But for areas where vaccination rates are high, it means it's back to work season.
The idea of going back to an office is giving workers mixed feelings.
I'm looking forward to that separation from work and home.
Being more present with my family has been just absolutely terrific.
And increasingly, in recent weeks, we have seen bosses suggesting, cajoling, even outright demanding their employees to get their butts back in the office. So what are these conversations going to look like in the coming months, and how should workers approach them? ABC's chief business and economics correspondent Rebecca Jarvis is with us. Rebecca, when is this going to become a huge thing? Like, is it September? Do you have a date circled on your calendar or what?
After Labor Day, it gets very real, but it already is a conversation, Brad, that most CEOs, most founders are having, and frankly, most employees are having this conversation, whether it's among each other or with their managers. And there are some really complicated issues here.
Well, and I want to ask you about how individual employees, like how some of our listeners should navigate these conversations. I do wonder if we should talk first about what their bosses are thinking about right now, right? Because I feel like when I see these CEOs issue messages about how excited they are to see everyone again in person, I almost see this panic behind their eyes, right? Like you seriously can't work from home forever, employees.
Please, come
what
back.
Is going through the mind of a CEO?
So thing one is there's a lot of contradictory research on this. Depending on the outcome you want, the research will tell you that. So, for example, there are studies that say that people are more productive working from home. Well, there's an equal amount of studies that say people are less productive, that small businesses, for example, can't keep tabs on their employees and they feel like communications have suffered as a result. Industries and companies are treating this differently.
Millions of Americans have adjusted to working from home. And now Twitter says most of its employees can keep that up if they want to forever.
In things like the banking industry, where JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs have told their employees, we need you in 5 days a week.
JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon says he's fed up with Zoom calls and is ready to get workers back to the office.
And then there are other banks like Citigroup who are hoping that by offering flexibility, that will allow them to attract more talent.
Citigroup, Microsoft, and Google have announced a hybrid model, a mix of work from home and the office for their employees.
Right now, this is sort of a business-to-business employee-based decision. But in the longer term, when you have cities that say our downtowns have been carved up.
Pick any street on any day of the week, and downtown San Francisco pretty much feels like a Sunday morning.
There are the small businesses, the food vendors, for example, who are going out of business, still right. Potentially at risk, crime rates rising. I predict that not that long from now, you're going to have citywide calls for businesses to bring their employees back, because what you have right now are huge amounts of commercial real estate that is going unused.
It's probably 10 to 15% occupied.
Only 10 to 15. In other words, only one or two out of 10 floors in one of these things is actually filled.
All the surrounding businesses, the coffee shops, the restaurants, they don't have a reason to be there right now. And yet they're trying. They're hanging on with, especially if they got some government aid. But without people back in those offices, it completely changes the dynamic. So
it becomes like a civic responsibility of the company. A mayor might think, hey, companies, you really need to get your people back for me, please.
And you're starting to hear those initial rumblings of saying, come back.
That greatly affects restaurants that rely on the lunch business, because right now there's none because no one's going to work in the seaport, that relies on the happy hour and, of course, relies on dinner.
We do our work inside Morgan Stanley offices, and that's where we teach. That's where our interns learn. That's how we develop people.
If you think about these major banks that are telling their employees they need to return, if you think about the business of what these banks do, they own real estate, or they own interests that own real estate. And if their own employees aren't working back in the big, big buildings that already exist and are meant for workers to sit in them and populate them, they're essentially undermining their own financial interests, which are separate from their employees, but their own significant financial interests.
If you want to get paid New York rates, you work in New York. You know, none of this, I'm in Colorado, I'm working in New York and getting paid like I'm sitting in New York City. Sorry, that doesn't work.
So it's important to also keep in mind, there are some businesses where they have these big investments in space. And if they're not putting people in those investments, then they've wasted huge amounts of money and they put a lot of future money at risk as a result.
If you can go to a restaurant in New York City, you can come into the office. And we want you in the office.
Now, at the same time, employees, by and large, like the flexibility. People have moved away. You've seen mass changes in where people live and locate. My hope, and I think I speak for a lot of employees here, is that there will be some hybrid thing where we don't have to go back fully to the way things used to be, but we don't necessarily adhere wholly to the pandemic world either.
Wow, which makes me think then that a lot of these conversations are not just about the worker, right? It's about the literal, like the elites of business, of local governments, these people who know each other, who have interests vested in each other, saying we need to figure out a reason, a way to get people back in the office. Let's talk about then advice to workers who do want to keep working from home somehow, hybrid, full-time, whatever. How would you approach that with your boss?
So this really depends on what the policy is of the company. If your company already offers hybrid remote work and says that that's the way of the future, you're in luck. You can sit down with your manager and have a pretty straightforward conversation. If you're working at a company that says remote work isn't possible or only in special cases, then you really have to think through why it is not just beneficial to you, but beneficial to your company that you will be working remotely. Maybe you have a 2-hour commute and perhaps you could be working during that 2-hour commute. Not sure the boss will totally go for that because, again, you have bosses who are saying, well, you need to be in the right city, location, what have you.
Yeah, move closer.
Yep. They could say that. But put together a plan. Solve every question for them. How are you going to communicate? How are you going to stay in touch with your team? How's your boss going to keep tabs on what you're doing? And make it as simple and easy for your company to say yes as you can. Set up a meeting with your manager. Go over the list. Be prepared to hear no. What you could say, if there is a no, is, could we try this? Why don't we give it a temporary 1-month trial? And if the trial goes well, then let's approach this again fresh and think about how we could do it in the long run. If it doesn't work out, then we'll reassess then. You also, in those situations, you do have to be prepared to leave, because sometimes that's your only negotiating tool. Maybe it will help you in your company, or maybe you'll find another opportunity that works better for the lifestyle that you want.
Good. Okay, just finishing up my bullet points here. Next time I have a conversation with my boss, Rebecca Jarvis, really helpful for our listeners, really helpful for me.
I hope so.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm putting together my own list. Thanks, Brad.
All right, we're going to step away real quick. But when we come back, a small fish in a big pond can just become a really big fish. One last thing is next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And one last thing, summer fairs are back, and so are the amazing experiences that go with them. Walking out with some funnel cake, or a big plush toy, or that goldfish you won by being an expert ping pong ball thrower.
Oh, you got one!
Well, what people never talk about is how that little fish can become a freak show of its own. In lakes across the country, officials are finding thousands upon thousands of goldfish, likely as a result of people who would just rather rehouse their pet fish instead of flushing it. But some of these goldfish have grown to absurd sizes. The Washington Post talked to lake keepers in Minnesota who have now caught goldfish as large as footballs. After all, we think of them as tiny, but these creatures can live up to 4 years and weigh up to 25 pounds in the right environment. And to a goldfish, an American lake is a great environment. For one, they're fresh water. For two, predators there are not used to them. They're not native. In fact, that's one of the reasons scientists say these goldfish are taking over lakes. Technically, they're an invasive species, and left to their own devices, they grow, outbreed everything else, and then change the water quality of their habitat. As a result, residents are under warnings in several states not to release a pet goldfish into a local pond. You might think you're being kind to the goldfish, but you also might be creating a monster. I did not know this. Goldfish can get trapped in ice and then just keep on living without oxygen for months, which again, makes it that much easier to crowd out every other animal at the lake. Also, this just makes me feel horrible for having a goldfish die on me when I was 9. Like, they can survive anything, except apparently the Milky household. Remember, if you enjoy the show, hit us up with a rating and review. It really does make a difference. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your fish about the show. I'm sure they want to hear. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.